to, in a work session, we're going to ask to be transferred to other committees. Senate Bill 1117, Senate Bill 1085, and House Bill 2813.
Chair, yes. We had a request to transfer Senate Bill 1117 to the Senate Committee on Rules. If committee members agree, then we need a motion to move this bill out of this committee with no recommendation and onto Senate Committee on Rules.
Okay, Senator Myers moves that, Senate Bill 1117 be moved to Rules Committee without recommendation. Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, we have Senate Bill 1085.
Yeah, we'll put a work session on that.
Requested moving this bill from the committee with no recommendation to the Senate Committee on Transportation.
And Chair moves Senate Bill 1085 to the
Committee on Transportation
without recommendation. Objections? So ordered. Hopefully we'll probably carry on Senate Bill, or no, House Bill, excuse me, House Bill, or 28. Better open up a work session. House Bill 2813.
We have a request for this committee to move House Bill 2813 out of committee with no recommendation and to the Senate Committee on Public Affairs.
Chair would move House Bill 2817 to the Senate Bill, or I mean House Bill 2813 to the Committee on Public Affairs. Any objections? So ordered. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 931. That's a...
Are you pointing at me?
Yeah, 931, yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Bowen. I'm here today representing Portland General Electric. A couple of weeks ago, you had an initial hearing, public hearing on Senate Bill 931, which is somewhat of a housekeeping measure, changing the dollar threshold for public utilities that are selling or transferring property at which they must obtain prior approval from the PUC. Senator Miller raised some questions about extending that threshold beyond the $100,000 level suggested in the bill, and we did a little research on that, and basically found that if you took the 28 years since the $10,000 limit was established, that would result in a $40,000. If you applied the inflation rate over that 28 years, it would result in a $40,000 limit. In consultation with the PUC and the other regulated utilities, US West, Northwest Natural, and Pacific Core, we determined that raising that to $100,000 was prudent. And I guess what I'm saying is that after taking a look at the matter and reviewing the thought process that went into arriving at $100,000, we determined that it was appropriate to leave it at that level for the time being.
Okay, any comment? If I did open up, I always a work session, I'm open for a work session, just in case I haven't, I won't do that. Any comments?
Well, I'm just curious as to how they described the thought process that went into the higher number, but that's all right.
The best we could.
Any other comments?
Could we move that bill?
Senator Starr has moved that we Senate Bill 931 move to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Objections? So ordered. Who would like to carry this?
Oh. I'll carry it.
Yeah. Would you like to do that?
Yeah.
Brian, I don't know.
Like me something, Brian?
Okay. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1055. Sigourney.
Oh. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Brian Doherty, and I represent the Western States Petroleum Association, a member of which is now called Equilon Enterprises. Equilon Enterprises is the merger of the retail operations of Texaco and Shell that you may have read about over the past year. What has happened is, as a result of that merger, the convenience store liquor licenses held by Texaco cannot be transferred to Equilon. And this bill is the eighth of seven other exceptions to the Tide House laws that are Oregon Liquor Control Commission laws that prohibit a manufacturer of alcoholic beverages from owning a retail operation. The statute has been extended to this extent, as a position paper I provided the members establishes. An outside director of Anheuser-Busch and an outside director of Shell Oil is also an outside director of Shell Oil Company. Both are parent companies of the manufacturer Anheuser-Busch and now the retail distributor Equilon. We created a very narrow exception simply to allow Equilon to obtain the same alcoholic beverage license as Texaco now enjoys for its enterprise by simply exempting this set of facts from the Tide House law. We've spoken to the OLCC. They have no opposition. I believe the chair has a note from the OLCC indicating they do not oppose it. We have talked with the beer and wine distributors and wholesalers. Mr. Paul Romaine has indicated he has no objection. I believe has notified the chair of that. We have talked with the breweries and wineries. What this statute simply does is allow Equilon, with a common board membership of the parent company, to operate these licenses. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We did turn in a request for an amendment to the bill language, and even though we do not have the LC version for the amendment in your staff measure summary copy in front of you, there is a two-point summary indicating the content of the amendment. And basically, what the change would accomplish is to further narrow that exemption, which means instead of the current bill language allowing for a member of the board of directors, this is in the bill page 2, sub 8, which is line 32, talks about a member of the board of directors of a corporation that is a manufacturer or a member of the board of directors of a parent company, etc. We took out the corporation that is a manufacturer or a member of the board of directors, which means we're now only talking about the board of directors of a parent company of a corporation that is a manufacturer and the board of directors of a parent company of a corporation that is a retail licensee. So the staff measure summary reflects the change, which is proposing the amendment, so you don't have the official LC language. I just want to bring that to your attention.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, I thank Ms. Shang for bringing that up. It is an amendment. I did provide each of you, I think, a hand-engrossed version that would show that. I have more copies I could provide to you right now if you would like, that has the changes that we've mentioned. I also attached to your packet is the proposed amendment that Ms. Shang just presented to you.
Okay. You got to get through these proposed amendments. We really can't move the bill until we get to the Jeff, Senator Byer.
I wonder if this is sort of agreed to between the OLCC and the proposals.
Yes, and particularly Mr. Romaine. All those amendments have been presented to the parties I've mentioned, and all of them with those changes are in agreement with the bill.
Mr. Chair, one option that we have is if we didn't want to make the amendments here because of the bill, we just move the bill and make it catch up to the amendments in House Bill.
Have any problem with that?
I don't. I have an agreement to put these through, but I would be glad to put on the House side and do that. I know Ms. Chang has scheduled this bill for Wednesday, next Wednesday afternoon.
We'll schedule a work session for Wednesday. So if committee members have all the questions addressed today, it will be a 2-minute obligation.
Okay. Sounds very good. Thank you, Brian. Close the public work session and schedule this for our public hearing and have a work session next Wednesday on this bill. Now we'll go back to the front of us. So we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1086. Paul Carco, Betsy Earls, and Annette Talbot.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
There's a very distinguished group here from the Highland Park Elementary School.
Yes. Wow. Hi there.
Welcome.
Said welcome.
Yeah, our best behavior.
Yes. Yeah, certainly try to be welcome. Happy that you're here.
Senator Hartline.
Senator Hartline. Very good. Hi.
Chairman Paul Cosgrove, representing VIE VI, which requested this bill, and I appreciate the committee introducing it at our request. To my right is Bill Skoranek, who is the president of VIE, and I'll explain in just a minute what that company is. He is a just recently became a Californian. He has lived in this state until April 1st, but he assures me that weather in San Diego has been worse in the last 3 weeks than it has been in Portland.
That's not hard to believe. You had your credibility.
This bill deals with how lenders and borrowers obtain verification of income and employment when they're applying for loans. Under the old system that we have used for many, many years, when someone goes in to get a loan, generally a mortgage loan, they need to sign a consent form that is mailed off to their employer. Their employer's personnel office, generally speaking, fills it in and mails it back. And that can be a relatively tedious process, especially if there's more than one employer. This bill would set up a process to get that information online by accessing the records kept by our employment department, which are reported about Oregon workers to the Employment Department as part of the employer's obligations to make reports for the purposes of unemployment insurance premium payments. There are five other states that have currently implemented this program, the first being Iowa in 1995. There are several more that are about to implement this. I'd like to ask Bill to describe briefly how this program works, what the consent contains, what the benefits are for lenders, and by the way, this is a bill that's been endorsed by the United Financial Lobby, what the benefits are for consumers and employers, and then how the system works in terms of the Employment Division and Department's costs and how those are reimbursed. If that's all right, Mr.
Sure.
Chairman.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Bill Skoranek. I am president of VIE, which is a joint venture between Norwest Mortgage and First American Financial. The process that we are attempting to have passed here in the state would allow, as Mr. Cosgrove said, the access of the unemployment insurance wage records for employment verification purposes. The U.S. Department of Labor issued a program letter allowing the access of this information to consumer reporting agencies such as VIE. VIE is not only obligated to follow the U.S. Department of Labor's program directive, but also the Fair Credit Reporting Act as well. Specifically, we need to allow only permissible purpose of this type of report for credit granting purposes, which are primarily mortgage loans, but also consumer finance, as well as tenant screening. Also, the consent must come from the consumer directly. They must be made aware of the fact that the information will be accessed directly from the state wage records. They also have to consent to the fact that this is voluntary, and if they do not provide consent for the release of this information, it will not affect their loan process. This is, in essence, a value-added service to the loan process. It benefits the lenders by allowing them to expedite the loan process. Also, it's beneficial to the borrower because it allows them to get their loan a little bit quicker. It's beneficial to the employer because it takes them out of the employment of the verification of employment business, which, of course, they're not in. And also, it benefits the department because we do provide a monthly revenue stream to the department based on the transactions. VIE also will pay for all startup costs required to establish connectivity, hardware, software, etc. with the department. And as I mentioned, we provide on a monthly basis a revenue stream that previously had not been accounted for by the department.
Mr. Chairman, there are some amendments, and Ms. Talbot from the Employment Department and I have worked those out. They are attached in non-LC form, although they've been submitted by Ms. Shane to LC and should be ready by the time the work session is here. they're really relatively technical amendments. I've seen Ms. Talbot's testimony, and hers goes over them in more detail, so I won't. But they are to clarify some matters and to add some language that we, the department asked for and that we agreed to.
Okay.
We'd be happy to answer any questions if you have
any. I'll go ahead right now. Go ahead. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. Good afternoon, members. We have Senate Bill 1086 before you. You've already heard the purpose of the bill. Just to review briefly for your background purposes, the wage information, as the previous speakers indicated, is submitted by employers. It's submitted on a quarterly report form. It's actually a combined form that we use with Department of Revenue and Workers' Comp. This form submits information about wages that are covered by unemployment insurance by the social security number of the individual employee. Generally speaking, the department's policy has been that this wage information belongs to the employer, since they're the ones who submit it, and certainly some of them consider it proprietary information, and it is very confidential. So the only time we release the information to individual employees is if they've claimed unemployment insurance benefits. And we do that for two reasons. One, so they can verify the wage records are accurate, and two, to see how much they may be entitled to if they do have a valid claim. This bill says that the individual may consent to the disclosure of these records for a specific consumer transaction. And we would offer for consideration of the committee to whether or not employers might be able to have an opportunity to decline to have their information electronically released if they so desire. This is something that the department offers for your consideration because our current policy does consider that to be the employer's information. Obviously, the previous speakers have some concern with that because that may increase their costs and they wouldn't have universal access to the wage records. But it is a concern we felt we would bring to your attention, a policy decision that obviously you can make one way or the other. We did appreciate working with the sponsors or the requesters of this bill because we were able to clarify some information before we start a process of negotiating with them, assuming this bill passes, about what information is already online. That we do have a lag time in terms of recording it and getting it from the employer. So by the time they get the wage information, it may be 5 months old, but they understand that. So the other is the issue of making sure, because of federal requirements, that in fact all the costs associated with this release of information are in fact covered by the consumer reporting agencies, instead of using our federal dollars to cover such costs. And they have been, the amendments and the language of the bill are very specific in that. Other states have found that they spend some time cleaning up these wage records for purposes of making sure that what the employers are getting is accurate. And we would attribute those costs and assign those costs to the sort of startup costs and transaction fees that the consumer reporting agencies like VIE would be charged. Third, we have a concern, as you've probably seen in the paper, sometimes people do take on other identities, and there are possible times where the information may be wrongfully released, generally inadvertently, obviously. But we wanted to be clear that the Employment Department would not have liability for those improper releases, so that was also agreed to by the requesters. So we decided to answer any questions, if you have any.
Is it possible to have some problems when you're signing up for this release? Would you have a whole series of papers in front of you and not know what you were signing and maybe not want to sign it? How is that going to be handled?
In the process of the loan granting procedure, obviously there are a great number of documents that they are required to sign. VI has asked its customers, its lenders, to create a separate consent form that clearly defines and outlines the use and the purpose of the information, separate from the standard loan application documentation that they need to sign. We audit our process daily. At least 5% of our transactions are audited daily to ensure that there was permissible purpose as well as a signed consent for credit and acknowledgement by the consumer that they were made aware of the use of this data. Moreover, Pete Marwick, the independent accounting firm, on a biannual basis, audits our records and also sends out letters to consumers confirming that the information was made aware to them at the time that they signed the documentation. And to this point, we have not found in any case that a consumer has not been made aware of the fact that this information was to be accessed.
I might add, Mr. Chairman, in the loan processing process, this comes at the beginning when there are not so many documents. This comes when there is an initial truth in lending disclosure about the estimated terms of the loan and consents to get credit reports to have income verification to verify amounts in bank accounts. The big bulk of the paperwork on most mortgage loans comes at closing, and this has already been signed, so it's, I think, less likely to be lost in the mix.
Okay. Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Let's say you want to testify. We have a
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm also a member of the Employment Department Advisory Council, although I'm not representing that group today. AOI, as you probably heard by now in this session, is Oregon's largest business organization. We represent over 19,000 businesses. Our members employ over 30% of Oregon's entire private workforce. Employees of those businesses sometimes need to obtain information of their employment and income for purposes of applying for mortgages and other loans, and allowing creditors to obtain this information on an automated basis from Employment Department records would relieve a paperwork processing burden on Oregon's employers. This would especially benefit smaller employers who often don't have the luxury of a full or even part-time personnel office. Although Employment Department policy has generally considered information reported by employers for the purposes of unemployment insurance taxes to be the employer's confidential data, employees are allowed to obtain a copy of their earnings history upon request. The process proposed in 1086, where an employee signs a consent form to allow a third party to get online access to that employee's information, is really not any different from the current policy that permits an employee to obtain this information directly. If a provision were added to Senate Bill 1086 requiring an employer's consent before release of this information, the advantages to employers and employees of the automatic access system proposed in this bill would be lost. AOI would not support requiring employers to give their consent for release of this information, nor allowing them to opt out upon request, because we feel that there are sufficient protections in the bill to preserve the confidentiality of information submitted by employers. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You're in support of the bill.
We are.
Questions? We'll have, thank you, Betsy. I guess we'll have amendments proposed for next week. We'll have a scheduled work session for that. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing. On. Set about 1086. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 254. Mr. Kaplinger. Kaplinger. You're my constituent. I better get your name right, hadn't I? How are you doing today?
Chairman Nelson and members of the committee, my name is Richard Kaplinger, and I'm employed by Pendleton Grain Growers, which is a farm co-op in Umatilla County, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 254. Actually, I think that Senate Bill 254 does two things. It will do two things. It will relax the time limit for perfecting purchase money security interest on true fixtures like well casings and buried irrigation pipe, pump houses, building annexes, and hundreds more of true fixtures. And the other thing it will do is it will define fixtures to exclude domestic pumps and accessories of pumps that are easily removable and without destroying the essence of the physical nature of the pump, and which shouldn't be considered fixtures. I want to point out that I've been doing this financing of domestic pumps for about 30 years, and probably several hundred financing agreements, and I've been forced to repossess only one pump during that time. Bankruptcy debtors tend to, in fact, always reaffirm their pump contracts. They need those pumps. And especially if purchase money security interest is filed, where they would ordinarily lose that if they didn't reaffirm it. On the other hand, I've written off bad debts on several pump contracts when I didn't get the PMSI, the purchase money security interest, filed because of a late filing. Happens once in a while. The current fixture filing requirements present several onerous burdens on the people who use them, the companies which sell and finance these fixtures. And the burdens are the shortness of the time to perfect the security interest, 10 days, and the time-consuming requirement of a legal description, which requires considerable interaction with not only the debtor, but the county recording officers. And then the third thing is this whole process thwarts sales. It many times, almost every time, the buyer will ask, do you really need to have a mortgage on my place to do this? And, of course, you explain that this isn't a mortgage on your place, but just the same, it seems like it's a mortgage. And giving out that land description makes it harder to make the sale. I want to say a little bit about who might be adversely affected by this. The first group would be mortgage companies, and this is only because the increase in time to file will give more fixture filings purchase money security interest status. In other words, if you filed after 11 days now, you wouldn't have a purchase money security interest, but you would if we change that to 20. So there will be fewer mortgage companies that inherit what I consider to be our collateral. And the other group is title insurance companies. They will have to make UCC searches at the Secretary of State level as well as the county level. In most cases, they already do this because there's often, right now, most sales, there's some personal property that passes. In order to check that personal property out, find out if there's security interest in that, they do a security interest check with the Secretary of State. So I don't think this will be adverse to anyone in an extreme manner.
Okay, I just have some questions on Section 4, too, if you could kind of explain that a little bit more. What, Sherry, do you recall what the specific, just the whole section itself?
Okay, now we're talking about...
Could you explain the intent behind Section 4 relating to the financing statement or continuation statement?
I'm working my way down here.
Take it. Do you have a copy of the bill?
Yes, I do have. I'm looking at it. So this is basically housekeeping, that part there. Starting the financing statement referred to in ORF 79-410.
Yes, and the sub 2.
Sub 2.
Is the intent strictly to clarify the financing statement or continuation statement and effective date relating to this act, or is there anything new here?
I don't think there's anything new. I think this is just saying that when the law changes, there's going to be some that will be without a home, and it defines how those are going to be handled.
Okay.
Really, we're not talking about a long time. We're talking about 10 days. So There shouldn't be the night that this goes into effect. There will be some that will suddenly change and have an extra 10 days to file.
Yeah.
And I think that's all that's referring to right
there. Thank you.
Is there any further questions? Thank you very much for coming down, Richard. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions here? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 254 and open up a work session. Senate Bill 254, the chair would move Senate Bill 254 to 4 with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Objections? So ordered. I'll carry. To start the process, we'll have to get hold of Representative Jensen to work this thing on the House side, so keep that in mind. You have to make another trip down here. All right, thank you very much. There we go. Okay. Open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 915, directs the Attorney General to create a database. Come on up. Welcome again, Pete.
Chair, members of the committee. You have some testimony for the committee. I'm sorry.
Well, telecommunications. Are we going back on? It's 1:42 again. What are we doing here?
Take a look at it.
No, that's all right.
For the record, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. I took the liberty of asking two colleagues to come to the witness stand. Hopefully, we could save some time for the
please,
record.
Thank you very much.
Let them introduce themselves to the committee.
I'm Bruce Shaw with Sprint.
Gary Bauer, Oregon Telecommunications Association.
Mr. Chair, the Department of Justice does not support the bill as introduced. We believe there is a real consumer problem here, and there's also a real problem for businesses that want to abide by our consumer protection laws. However, we don't believe the answer is to create a new state bureaucracy or to require the Department of Justice to do what it would be required to do under the bill is introduced. Let me very briefly describe the nature of the problem as a prelude to the punchline, which is that I believe that we are close to closing the gap between the various parties in connection with this proposal, and am hopeful that we can report back to the committee at the committee's earliest convenience with a consensus proposal that will both strike a blow for businesses wanting to comply with Oregon law and also for consumers in respect to this proposal. The core of the problem from the consumer standpoint arises from those inconvenient phone calls that I'm sure all of you have received from telephone solicitors who contact you to offer you goods or services, often at the most inopportune moments. Oregon law provides a mechanism to secure a measure of security against such intrusions, and that mechanism is known as the Black Dot Law. And basically, what it says is that you can pay your telephone directory company, if the company chooses to offer the service in your area, which most do, a monthly fee. Often I understand it's 50 cents a month. And in return for that, a notation will be embedded in the telephone directory that indicates your desire not to receive unsolicited commercial telephone calls. The problem from the consumer standpoint is that is really a flip side of the problem from the business's standpoint, and that is that these lists are only updated as often as the directories are republished, in some cases perhaps a year. So a year might elapse between the time the consumer opted for to be listed on the Do Not Call list and the time that that list then became accessible to a business that wanted to screen its list against the Do Not Call designation. Secondly, the original law was passed establishing the Black Dot provision at a time when the availability of data about consumers' telephone numbers was much more restricted. That is, the primary source for such telephoning lists at that time were telephone directories. Now there are a great many sources of lists of telephone numbers of likely customers. And the existing law doesn't appear to provide any protection for a business that makes a call to a consumer based upon a list that was not derivative of the telephone directory. So a business could find itself running afoul of at least the text of the existing law very innocently. So we have been working to try and work out a solution that will address this problem for consumers and for businesses. And I summarized our proposal, ours being the Department of Justice's proposal, in the Dash 1 amendments. My testimony in the bullet points I provided briefly outlined that. But rather than going through that proposal in detail, though I think it will form the framework for the agreement that we're attempting to negotiate, I'll now turn the microphone over to Mr. Shaw.
Okay, here we have some guests. What are you folks
from? Highland Park.
More Highland Park. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we're talking about Bill, about telephone solicitation. You know, in the phone book, you've got a little black dot. Have you ever seen those things? And that's to prevent people from calling you. But we're finding out that's not entirely 100% effective. So he's never testifying as to how we can maybe change that. Please proceed.
Thank you very much, Senator Nelson. Members of the committee, my name is Bruce Shaw again, representing Sprint. And I guess in the strictest terms, today we are opposed to Senate Bill 915 as it's written. However, I think, as Mr. Shepard has indicated in the last couple of days, we've come very, very close, not only in concept to rectifying the situation, but I think with maybe even some actual language. And we'd like to have some time to continue to work on that, if you will. Nothing like a deadline to kind of get people together.
That's good, yeah.
I think Mr. Shepard hit on the exact problem here. Basically, people don't get their lists from the directory anymore. They get them from a number of different places, and telemarketing firms certainly don't go to the directory and get their list. They get them from a whole bunch of different places, county fairs, when you sign up for a card, a credit card, anytime you give your telephone number, your address, you know what happens to your mail. So basically, I think what we had proposed, and I had talked to Mr. Shepard about, was maybe coming up with an idea where instead of having a specific list for Oregon, and our concern on this bill was that national companies such as Sprint would have to check with Oregon, with Washington, with California, with individual, 50 individual states. We kind of wanted one place to go to look at, a national list. And Sprint is a member of the Direct Marketing Association, has been for years, and they have a national list that is available to both members and non-members. Mr. Shepard and I, again, have been talking about maybe structuring Senate Bill 915 that would, in such a way that would provide for checking against such a national list without maybe specifying the Direct Marketing Association specifically. Those are what we are in consultation and negotiation over as we speak. We had, from my testimony, you see, I thought that if we could use a national list, it would prevent the customers from paying a $10 fee. The Department of Justice would not have to administer such a list or go out to contract or, make additional expenses to administer that list. And then, but lastly, that the company who makes telephone solicitation calls would be contacting only those persons that are interested in receiving calls and hearing about products and services and signing up. So we think it might be a win-win-win. And I think, as we have talked over the last even less than a day, basically, I think we are really making quite a bit of progress. So we're opposed as written, but not the concept, I guess, is the message, and we'd like to continue working together on it.
Okay, very good. Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Gary Bauer with the Oregon Telecommunications Association. As you've probably seen in other bills, we've kind of got a little split personality on this issue. But this actually was the initial bill that you had before you, original Senate Bill 915, was started by a small telephone company, the Halen Telephone Company over on the coast, who was just basically reacting to customers, asking them to do something, to stop telemarketing calls And there are a number of problems when you have a telemarketer, not just the one of them calling during the dinner hour, for example. But they do buy a black dot from them, and that company actually decided to no longer offer the black dot because they felt that they were doing a disservice to their customers by saying, yes, you can purchase a symbol in the telephone directory, only to then have them turn around and still get telephone calls. So they are no longer intend to offer that service. There was another concept that they had asked to put in the legislation, but Mr. Shepard says that it doesn't comply with some recent court cases, and that had to do with automatic dialing machines. The fact that sometimes you will receive a call and there's no one there. Telemarketers use an automatic dialing machine that basically goes out and dials and then looks back at their telemarketing boiler room, and when you pick up your phone, looks for a salesperson. If there's no salesperson, it terminates the call, so you don't think there's anybody on the other end. And they've had a lot of complaints, particularly from senior citizens who think that they're receiving harassing phone calls. So that part we weren't able to address. But the rest of the bill was designed to try to find a way to facilitate telemarketing, at the same time facilitate those customers who don't want to receive contact from them. And Mr. Shaw has pointed out some other avenues, and I think between the three of us we could probably develop a package for you.
Okay. Very good. Questions? Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll get you guys to work or
yes.
Come down, try and find an amendment someplace along the line.
Right.
Come back to us next week.
Okay.
Close public hearing on Bill 915. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1034. This modifies the definition of restricted energy electric activity for purposes of electrical licensing. Gary Wilson and Tony DeSanto. Welcome, Gary, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Gary Wilson. I'm Chief Electrical Inspector for the city, or for the state. I'm representing Billing Codes Division. And our position on Senate Bill 1034, which modifies the definition of restricted energy electric activity by increasing the present 100 VA, which is volt amperes limitation, to an unspecified value. The bill has that particular VA value as blank, as you notice. The division does not support this bill because it is inconsistent and conflicts with the national standards for limited energy systems. The value of 100 VA has been determined by Underwriters Testing Laboratory, UL as we know it, as a maximum value of power source that does not have sufficient energy to cause a shock or fire. Such power supplies, normally transformers, are operating at 120 volts on the primary windings to a lower voltage, such as 6, 12, or 24 on the secondary windings. Power supplies investigated to qualify for the category of limited energy are tested to American National Standard Institute, which is ANSI, UL, and identified as Class 2 and Class 3 type transformers. Consideration is given to these transformers for maximum current and for reasonable time to resolve for short circuit for tolerable voltages and separation for the primary and the secondary windings within the transformer. The National Electrical Code, better known as NEC, also limits the power supply of Class 2 and Class 3 limited energy circuits to 100 VA. The National Electrical Code allows limited energy circuits to be installed with a wiring method that is a lesser restrictive than the normal 120-volt lighting and receptacle circuits. Class 2 and Class 3 circuits may be installed in a cable suitable for the environment. Low-voltage systems have power sources greater than 100 VA are required by the National Electrical Code to be installed in the same manner as you would for power and lighting. Systems over 100 VA have sufficient energy to cause a shock and fire. We would like the proponents of this bill to reconsider this proposal to avoid conflicts with national standards. The division is willing to work with the steering committee in assisting the proponents to attain the goals while maintaining public safety. In essence, what does this mean? That means if you take a shovel and dig out in your front yard, and you have a 100 VA transformer, and your wife's working in a planter, and she hits these wires, nothing's going to happen to her. But when you start exceeding 100 VA volts, or watts of power, you just stick a shovel in there and somebody could get hurt. Somebody could get electrocuted. And that's our concern here is public safety. There's no restriction for putting in sprinkler systems or low voltage systems greater than 100 VA, but those type of systems have to comply with the National Electrical Code when it comes to installing power and lights. And when you get into that type of voltages, yes, as long as you have the proper license, you can do that. And that's why we have the termination, restricted energy, limited energy, and they're all based on the 100 VA value. Thank you. Any questions?
Bill can be fixed, though. I mean, I think here, if we get the right terminology and the right voltage and whatever we're talking about here.
Mr. Chairperson, I don't know where they're going with the VA. This is blank if you look at the bill. I don't know how high they want to go. Yeah. Anything over 1,000 volts, 1,000 VA, you can weld with.
Yeah.
So I don't know where they're going.
From my understanding, they were just going to be able to extend their sprinklers. So, Senator Starr, do you have some knowledge about this?
We do have a proposed amendment to insert 300 in the place of 100.
300 VA would put it into what we consider a Class 1 wiring. And that type of wiring under a 300 VA would have to be installed in conduit. And that would have to be done by a licensed electrician. So it's not prohibitive increase in the VA. It's the limited energy license that we're talking about here. These people that have this particular license are only qualified and been tested to install low voltage type circuitry.
Okay. Maybe we could get Tony and DeSantis and Ken Kendall up. That'd be possible. Just stay right there, Gary.
Sure.
You might have to answer some questions. We have more people coming in. What we're talking about is wiring for, I guess, underground sprinkler systems. Is that basically what we're talking about? Please introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Tony DeSantis. I'm a landscape contractor in Salem, and I'm here representing our Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. And I apologize for that bill coming through without a number in there. That was not intended. I didn't get a chance to see that. The 300 amps, as Senator Starr mentioned, is the goal. And our understanding has been, and I'm sorry, I don't have all the facts. I'm not an electrician. I'm a landscape contractor allowed to install low voltage up to 100 volt amps. And my understanding is that there's in the national code that there is a 300 volt amp limitation on this, and that's the reason we felt safe in proposing a 300 amp. From the practical side of it, I would like to explain why we feel it's okay to do this. When we install, and this is for landscape lighting, not irrigation. All of our irrigation wiring is well within the 100 volt amp limit, so this is for outdoor lighting. And at this point, we can install 100 volt amps. The way it's done is we go to a job site, we design the lighting system to do whatever the effects are necessary. Then we take the watts that are required to run those lamps. And if it exceeds 100 volt amps, that wiring all comes back to that transformer. If it exceeds 100 volt amps, we are allowed to install a second 100 volt amp transformer. Our wiring, the only wiring we do is from the transformer out to the fixtures, which is all low voltage wire, and it's done in multiple wiring runs, not a single wire. So we're not putting more volt amps into that wire. It goes out in multiple runs. The unit itself is a plug-in variety, similar you could buy at any hardware store, home and garden store, that any homeowner can buy. We'll plug that in and, as I said, run the wires to the various fixtures. What we're asking is that to simplify this, instead of two 100 volt amps or three or five, whatever it may take to supply the power needed for this particular lighting system, that we are able to install a larger unit, the same type of unit, a plug-in transformer that would supply 250 to 300 volt amps. The wiring is still going out in multiple runs, not a single run, because that wouldn't work. You can't overload wire, so we have to wire according to the capabilities of the wiring. I don't understand how it would change the public safety. It's a matter of just one larger central unit that plugs into a 110, which is installed by electrical contractors. I don't know if I've made that clear or not. Any questions?
Do you want to answer that quickly?
Sure, I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee? 100 volt amperes is that value that has not enough energy, like I said earlier, to shock or create a fire. When you get over 300 volt amperes, you leave the classification of power limited and go into power, and that's the difference. And when you go into power at 300 volt amperes, then the National Electrical Code would require that type of insulation to comply with the type of wiring that you would do with normal lights and power. It would be in conduit and wire. It's no longer defined in the National Electrical Code as power limited. Low voltage is defined in the National Electrical Code as anything under 600 volts, so it's a broad term on low voltage.
So the breaking off point at 300, you say?
Breaking off point for power limited is 100 volt amps.
Is there something at 300 or?
Well, and once you leave 100 volt amperes, okay, you go into what is called power, okay, not limited power. Okay. See, a power limited transformer is inherently constructed to where it has built in over current protection. If there's a short, that will open up that circuit automatically. If there's a prolonged overload, it will also open the circuit. Mm-hmm.
The nice thing about the 300, I guess, Tony, you talked about, you were under the impression there was a 300 right. amp or VA requirement. And so I'm just trying to find out if that really is there. Is there something like that?
Underwriters Testing Laboratories has examined some higher wattages. And like I said earlier, we'd be willing to work with the steering committee and address this subject and come up with some other parameters instead of increasing from 100 VA, say, to 300 VA. I think the division would be willing to work with, say, something still within the limitations or definitions of the Class 2 and Class 3 circuit.
Yeah. Very good.
I guess I go back to my point of, is we can install a lighting system that would have enough fixtures out there to require 500 watts. And we can do that legally now by installing, say, five of the 100 volt amp controllers or transformers. We're asking that we able to simplify that, save the customer money by installing two 250s or comparable. The same wiring happens. Nothing changes except the size of the unit that we plug in. Nothing changes except that.
Kim,
I don't have the technical terminology to answer, but that's the practical end of it. That's the way we install it, and that's the safety factor is still there. It's very safe.
Okay. Chair Nelson, I'm Ken Seabell. I'm the administrator of the Landscape Contractors Board. Just what I'd like to add to this, the discussion here is the history of this. In 1991, the ORS 479, 905 to 940, there were some changes made that allowed some exemptions, and that's when the landscape contractors received this exemption. If they're a licensed landscape contractor, they can do this electrical work. And they have to get a permit to do it. And so the questions come to me, not every week, but a considerable number of questions in the practicality of it. They come and say, we put in the newsletter, you're limited to 100 volt amps, and they come back and say, we don't have any authority with 100 volt amps. It's a complicated system. I'm not an electrician either. I'm just an administrator of a program that this is a good authority for them to have. If we can get some sort of an increase in that, it would even be better because it gives a better price break for the consumer.
Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen. If you can get together and try and work this thing out so we can, if there's something that can be practical, I'd sure appreciate that.
Mr. Chairperson, member of the committee, I want to point out that on the second paragraph that was submitted, it says Senate Bill 1034 would resolve this dilemma by simply updating the statute and changing the low voltage level of 300 amperes. That's an improper. 300 amperes is enough to go cold to plate with.
Volt amps.
That should be volt amps.
Okay.
I again apologize for that. I think in the rush to get something into the committee there wasn't enough review time on that, but I would agree that should be volt amps.
Hey, well, I think the difference between volt amps and amps is that's a big joke. Can you give me a real quick layman?
Volt amperes, VA, is actually power. That's where you take your volts times your amperage and you get your power. You're talking about like a Volkswagen with a little four-cylinder in it, you know. And then you can talk about some real power like a V8 underneath a high-performance Pontiac, something like that. And that's power. Current is how much you got going through there. How large is that amount of power coming out? That's what it, and the push, that's your voltage. I hope that simplifies that.
Push is voltage.
Yeah.
Amperes.
The amount of flow.
The amount of flow. Okay. I should know that. You know, I'm a farmer, but I...
It's difficult.
I don't get into those. I know what great team is. All right. Thank you very much. You folks can get together and try and work some out some of this language and something that you think can be reasonable. I sure appreciate it. Thank you very much, Tony, for coming in. Close the public hearing on 1034. And open up public hearing on... We're in 1116. I guess Gary is still, is Gary still here?
I don't know if he's
here. Maybe he got the wrong one. Oh, could have been, okay. And so, who do you want? Tom Sears, Leon Oliver, and Pat Bridget, and Fred Van Atta. If you all come up kind of close here, we'll... Welcome, gentlemen. Fred,
thank you. I am Fred Van Atta, appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon Building Industry Association. The issue is where building designers fit in the great world of regulation and unregulated. This issue has been before the legislature several times over my career around here. The building industry, the wholesalers, have always opposed changing anything, and that, and essentially there is no regulations of the industry. We have changed our position, and we are here to support some regulation, and Mr. Oliver will explain that in a minute. The language, there are some -1 amendments, which I believe you have before you, which significantly redoes the legislation to essentially a process of registration with the Building Codes Agency. We believe that the manufactured housing industry and the people who designed manufactured housing were not covered by the amendments there. That seems to be less clear than we believed it was, and we make a commitment on the record that if you move this bill forward today, we will, in the House, corral the appropriate parties and make it abundantly clear that it is not the intent to regulate folks who design manufactured housing. Most of that design work is done by professionals in other states, and the headquarters ships the plans to the factories, and it is not our intent to meddle in that business at all. There are probably a couple of other amendments that we may also want to work with, but we won't. We understand that you're pressed for time, and we will not belabor them here unless folks want to get off on it. I am joined from the OBIA by Pat Bridges, who's our codes and new technology specialist and knows building codes forwards and backwards, and Leon Oliver, who is essentially the author and principal proponent of this measure. Mr. Oliver was a builder and is now a designer from Grants Pass. And I will now turn the discussion over to Mr. Oliver.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Leon Oliver from Grants Pass, Oregon, and this is as far as I've gotten in the last 2-3 years on this issue, but it is not our intent to force anyone into or out of anything that is normally done currently in business, i.e. the mobile home manufacturers, but we have been overlooked and have no statutory recognition for our practice. This is basically buildings that are exempt under the architect's law that pretty much anyone can do. And we don't even intend that an owner-builder couldn't draw their own plans for their own owner-occupied home or small office. But the problem lies is when we get into some of the technical arena of building design and we run across problems at the building code or the building permit counter or that kind of thing, we have no statutory recognition at this point as a practice. And we can't even register with the Construction Contractors Board and be covered. The bond and insurance required by them does not cover our practice. It's simply not recognized. It doesn't exist. There's a lot of it going on, but it isn't there. And builders that design their own plans in-house are not covered by their bond and their insurance for that part of the practice. And the way the industry has gotten technical and more cumbersome with regulation, continuing education is certainly something that should be required by the administrator, and so we really need to go here.
My name is Tom Sears. I'm presently the president of the Northern Chapter of the American Institute of Building Designers. I am a past president of the Oregon Professional Wood Building Designers before we went on a national scope and created the American Institute of Building Designer, and I'm a past president of the Oregon Society of that. My main forte is that I have been the legislative committee chairman for the Designers Association for 18 sessions in 36 years. And I am now reaching the stage where I want to give up the post, and I would like to see this put to bed. During those 36 years, 10 years or 10 sessions out of the 18, I've been instrumental with our groups and stuff to ward off the architects from introducing legislation to put us out of business. Fortunately, the committee people and this House saw our way and had the legislation killed. The last two sessions were examples of legislation to put us out of business. The question has always been, anybody can be a designer. You want to be a designer, put up a sign tomorrow and advertise yourself on the designer. On the national level, the American Institute of Building Designers, we have a registration and we have an exam. 3 years ago, we pulled the exam section out of our AIBD organization, and they set up an independent group to do examinations and also to pursue doing exams for other trades that were at that time looking for some means of governing their body, which one was the Remodelers Association. Therefore, they're not connected with us, but our people, to be certified, must pass that examination now. Presently, our association has five categories: student, instructors, designers, professional designers, and certified professional designers. And we feel that is the one thing the architects did say, we, even though we've never really had that much trouble, that they're anybody can do it. We want to do national advertising. We want to also do local media advertising. But we would like to be in a position to know that if somebody hears the word designer, that they feel some assurance they're getting somebody that does know what they're doing. The state of Oregon is the number one state in plan books in the housing field. We put out more plan books, different firms within this company than any other state in the United States. We also are active in all kinds of national magazines and stuff that are plan magazines as well as Sunset and those where plans have occurred. We also, if you've seen the Sunday Argonian, when you see that little floor plan and the Sunday Argonian, that is also by the members of the Oregon Society of the American Institute of Building Designers. We have just instituted a very strict provision, a four-page document of how those plans are judged before they can go into that Sunday Argonian so that we are getting the best. We also are finishing up our web page, and that same criteria is going to be part of that web page. Therefore, we would like to have a position where we don't have to feel we're going to be out. During that 36 years, twice, the architects sat down with us and saw that something could be worked out. Both of those were eventual the annihilation of our profession. One, we would be licensed in, but as we died off, that would be the end of the exemption area. The exemption area was put in when they were licensed because they sat before a group like this, and the group said, well, no, that's fine, but what about all these people? So there's an exemption for single family and buildings up to 4,000 square feet in space and 20 feet in height from finished floor to the highest ceiling. And so they wanted to say, okay, you'll be out of business. That did not set us because we didn't want to put the people out of business. It is a great field, and it's a great field the state needs because it saves them millions of dollars because we work a lot cheaper. The other thing was, one time it was very tempting, and it was in kind of a probe that we were licensed, that they might grandfather a few of us in that were heavy with certain criteria that would limit it to the amount, and that would tempt us to sell our other people down the river and grab it and go home, which we did not do. So this we're trying to do, hopefully, to rectify that. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I want to test
hand for questions.
I'm just going to answer. All right, any questions? That's good. Yes. Sure.
Question is for the entire panel. In the proposed bill, there is quite a lot associated with the registration program. In the -1 amendment, basically, most of the elements are removed. So what we have now, if the committee adopts the -1 amendment, would be strictly a registration program DCDS would establish by rule, and building designers would be asked to register. And people who are architects or engineers who are otherwise qualified to do the work would not have to register. What good does this program do to have a registration program?
This would, if you're registered in the state of Oregon as a building designer, this would determine or would establish that you've met certain criteria and that you are keeping up with continuing education. And our intent with the revisions was to really put it into more of an administrative rule arena rather than statutory. Does that answer your question?
One of the things was when the first one came out, it says It talked about registering contractors, and it didn't name the other categories. And it, they were there, but somehow it got lost in the shuffle. And so it was indicating that contractors were the only ones that could be licensed as designers. And of course, our group had a heart attack and stated that we should get something through there. And we decided that to make it work, we realized, I mean, I've been here too many years to know to set up a whole big board and do all that and have all that money is going to be something to forget. And so by doing this and having them set up, now they might say, okay, this national organization that we have that does the testing, they might say, okay, you can get certified by them, that's good enough for us. And therefore, we pay a fee every year to this board, even though we're certified. We pay a fee to keep our certification to the board so that they can do their testing nationwide. And we have societies in about 30 states. And so this would say, okay, you guys work out all the how you're going to do it and then go from there. And we're kind of shooting the crap so they can go, okay.
Okay.
Chair Nelson, it was also our intent that it's the people under the authority of the Building Codes Division that really make the determination on whether plans are exempt or not under ORS 671. And so we felt that that division was the best to administer this program.
Okay. Further comments? Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Yeah. Oh, there, we do have a question. Wait a second. Senator Butler has a question.
The effect of this, if we were to adopt it, would it really do? Some people who might, for a friend or something like that, sell them the service of doing an addition to their house, would this preclude them from doing that and being compensated if they weren't registered?
Well, if they were doing it as a practice, as a business, then they should be registered. If it's a case of a one-time deal where someone has some drafting experience from prior life and, you know, that kind of thing. But if you're set up in business and you have a shingle out, then you should be registered. If you're a builder that generates house plans in-house, you should be registered. It's not the intent of this to keep private people from even hiring just a draftsman to draw up their own design for their own home.
But if the law exists now, they can do that.
Actually, if the law exists now, anyone can do that. There is no statutory recognition of the practice whatsoever.
Well, anybody can do it. The thing is, we are on the other end of that, just what you're discussing. When we have jobs that we might be involved in, and we need to go, because we're over the limitation, we need to go to an engineer or an architect. We'll use the word engineer because that's the services we're more after. It's been very heavy contention over the last 30 years. Are the engineers selling their stamp? No. If they take the documents and you give them the information and stuff like that, they take the documents, they study it, they do all the wind loads, the seismics, the beams and stuff like that. Because you happen to be working with somebody else and at that time you didn't need to be, you had to be in their office or did not be in their office. But people weren't, it was an irritation. But people were going, oh, those people that were putting a stamp on there had the documents to support what they were stamping, and they were turning that into the building department. Therefore, if you're registered, nobody's going to come, and I'm going to put a stamp on a set of drawings that I haven't reviewed and feel confident that this is a good set of plans. Whether there's somebody out there to do that, well, there's probably something in every trade, but I would say that it would be no more than the problem they have, and that problem with the engineers and the architects has subsided and practically gone out of deal with legislation to make it a lot more loose. They're leaving up to the individual to do his job.
Sure. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. And Diana.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Diana Medrieta. I'm the Executive Director for the Architects Council of Oregon. And the Architects Council of Oregon is a state layer of the National Institute of Architects, the American Institute of Architects, excuse me. I haven't been here for 16 sessions, so I'm not sure really what went on in the past. I do know that the national position for the architects is that there is a difference between a title registration and a practice registration. Title registration is intended to provide a means that the public can use for distinguishing trained, qualified practitioners and providers of a service from untrained or unqualified individuals. Title registration does not prevent other less qualified individuals from providing the services. It simply establishes a measuring stick against which their qualifications can be judged. A really great example of this is a landscape architect. Anyone can do landscaping, anybody that has like an eye for it. But to call yourself a landscape architect, you have to register with the Landscape Architect Board. But it does not restrict someone who chooses not to get that title from practicing landscape architecture. Practice regulation, however, because of its cost to the state and consumers and because it limits entry into a profession, is traditionally reserved by the state for professions and occupations that, if unregulated, pose a serious threat to public health, safety, and welfare. In evaluating whether a profession should be regulated, most states apply a set of objective criteria, which include, is the public being harmed by lack of regulation, and can such harm be documented? Are there alternatives to state regulation, and is the public protected by existing laws, codes, or standards, and would strengthening such laws solve the problem? And what is the cost to the state and the public of regulating the profession, and will the public benefit from such regulation? Well, we already have a line. We have a line that the building designers testified to as being very clear, and that is the line between non-exempt and exempt buildings. The buildings that are non-exempt for a reason, because the state does not see the need for them to be designed by an architect or an engineer. So the architects feel that if the building designers would like to have acknowledgement for their profession, which they should, and is a valid request, that they have a title registration. The language that they have here doesn't really get them there. And as Sherry pointed out, they've pretty much removed everything. So basically you're looking at just having a piece of paper that says these are the people who are building designers. There is no statutory requirements if they remove all of the things that they've removed, and there is no statutory authority to create those requirements. And so our concern is that we're not really creating a valid registration for building designers. And if you're not creating something that's valid, then the state itself is saying to the public, these people are valid without really having any reasons to say they're valid. So that is our concern. We are not opposed to building designers having registration. We are opposed to having them licensed.
Questions? Yes.
So, as the bill is proposed with the background amendments, are you opposed or supportive of it?
I wonder what it's registering. It
doesn't say licensing.
I suppose we wouldn't be opposed to it, but we wonder what's the point. If you're having a title registration, the whole point is to set yourself aside from the rest of the people in that industry. I took the time to maybe take some classes, or I took the time to take a test or to take some continuing education so that I could earn a title. My neighbor, who also practices the same profession, chose not to do those things, and they don't have that title. They're not allowed to call themselves that. They're not allowed to advertise that way. The public, when they go out to look for a building designer, a landscape architect, an interior designer, they're going through a similar situation. When they see registered whatever, that's the state putting a stamp on that person. If you're willing to put the stamp on every person who wants to call themselves a building designer, you basically have invalidated the reason for even having the registration in the first place.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe or Gary, do you guys, either one of you first want to testify from the department's point of view?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer, not Gary Wilson, as the testimony indicates. I've been running back and forth trying to cover two hearings in two different rooms. For the record, the department is neutral on this bill. It will have a fiscal impact on the division. There will be a requirement to provide staff and charge fees to perform this service. The division believes that this that the bill as currently laid out would allow the department to set some standards for what a building designer would be. And it would include both, you know, everything from producing one or two family dwelling plans, farm buildings, specialty contractors designing and producing plumbing, electrical, mechanical systems. So in terms of the Dash 1 amendments, we've only recently received those, but certainly would be our impression that there would be some standard in place. The other benefit that we do see in the proposal is that it would put in place a requirement for some continuing education. The department would request consideration of an amendment that would allow the division to look at education and or experience as a standard for qualifying as a building designer. Again, our original analysis was based on the original bill. Our concern there was that some folks may simply not be able to gain experience in this field, and we might get ourselves sideways with ADA requirements if we didn't leave the door open for getting in through education and or experience. And so with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Barr.
Joe, just reading this, it really doesn't say what standard you would use. I mean, your statutory authority is it's here, just says that by rule you'll establish a registration system. So I guess that something that broad, you could use whatever standards you thought were reasonable.
Through the chair to Senator Beyer, in reading that, our impression was that gave the authority to the department to design that registration system. And our intent was to require experience, training, and set some standard for that registration. I would agree with the comments that if it was simply a registration that would accept anyone without experience or qualifications, then yes, it would be meaningless and would be a waste of the state's resource to put such a registry together.
I suppose at the minimum, if you were requiring at least knowledge of the building code, that would certainly help the permitting process.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, that was our impression. We felt that requiring some knowledge of the code, some continuing education, would help facilitate the plan review process, would hopefully help us gain some consistency in terms of code compliance across the state.
How big of a problem has this been, the lack of a registration?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I can't speak to how big a problem the lack of a registration system has been. I can speak to the feedback that I get around the state around the difficulty in getting plans approved, the inconsistency across jurisdictional lines, some requiring engineering, some not. It's clear to me that some designers do submit plans that are woefully inadequate. And in that sense, setting some standard, I believe, would at least facilitate that process. Senator Beyer's been involved in our discussions around other bills around this issue and knows of the difficulties related to plan review and getting it performed in a timely fashion. There's two sides to that. There's the jurisdictions or the state's ability to respond, and there's also getting plans in the door that make some sense and have the information you need to be able to determine if they'll stand up.
Just comment, Joe, that a lot of the plans that I've seen that needed more information had stamps on them.
I'm glad that was only a comment.
Okay, well, any other questions, comments? Fair to you, any of you folks who want to respond to any of that, or please come up and reintroduce yourself. And
I have one comment for the young lady, Stephen's title.
Uh-huh.
A little about a year and a half ago, a young lady came to work for me with a degree from the University of Oregon in interior architecture. And she was designing her car, the interior architecture, and getting her degree on the wall. And I said, whoa, you can't put your degree on the wall, nor can you put that on your card. The law says, in order to use the word architect
architectural, you must have passed the test by the state of Oregon, or you can't use those words. And she's like, what do you mean? I can't use those words. And I said, well, I'd like to take you to Salem in the next session if I need you. Because you can't use them. I said, here's the sense. There's a guy that got called before the carpet now because he does architectural renderings. He draws nice renderings of a building and stuff like that. If he's drawn a rendering of the building over 4,000 square feet, because he got the plans from an architect, but he was just doing a rendering, he got called on the carpet because he's advertised as architectural rendering. Mm-hmm. Titles are important, but they're being abused.
And do you have any response to comment? I mean, you don't have to have one.
Well, first off, the profession doesn't set the administrative rules. That's a state agency that sets those, and they've respect. You know, so and I don't think that's the issue here. To get back to what our real concern is, that there's a scope to say that only building designers can do this work is going to put people out of business. And you hear them talk about they don't want to put anybody out of business. Well, you will if you say only building designers can do this work and then you have a registration for it. Some people are not going to be able to register for that. Some people are not going to pass whatever standards they set up. And we have a problem with that. If there isn't huge life safety issues, why are we licensing them?
Okay. Well,
you could make that same issue for engineers and architects. I mean, the scope of practice, anytime you establish a scope of practice, you're limiting who can do it.
An architect and engineer goes through 5 years of education to become an architect or an engineer, and I imagine that there isn't many people in this room who would like to walk into a building that's over 2 feet high that wasn't designed by an architect or an engineer. The reason the state requires them to do certain buildings is because of their educational background. A building designer does not have the same educational background, and they have a limit to what they can do. And we're not arguing that. We're not arguing the validity of the profession. We're just saying that should we limit people from being building designers strictly by saying you have to meet these certain standards?
I think we've got enough controversy here, enough things to discuss, so I want our action parties to just get together. If you can't work something out, really, everybody. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 116, open up the Senate Bill hearing, public hearing for Senate Bill 1257. Gentlemen. We have Terry McDonald, Donna Lamb, and Duggan Petty. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for your patience and coming to this meeting here on a Friday afternoon. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is
Chair Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Donald Lamb. I'm a board chair for St. Vincent de Paul, and you sometimes see me around here with the Oregon Catholic Conference. Senate Bill, we're in favor of Senate Bill 1257. It's a relatively simple bill. Its idea was to attempt to increase the amount of recycled materials used by the public. St. Vincent de Paul and Lane County is in the recycling industry by attempting to create a product that can be resold, value enhanced, creating jobs, and stopping waste and improving our landfills from filling up. That's the basic premise behind it. Having said that, apparently we find out that in this idea being conveyed to LC that we created a minor discrepancy, and that will be addressed by Mr. Petty from the Department of Administrative Services, but basically it's a very simple bill to increase recycling, ask the public to do 5 to 10% or more of the products that they put in, that they purchase, the good standard products to be recycled materials. And with that, I will let Mr. McDonald, Chair McDonald of St. Vincent de Paul and Eugene, talk about the nuts and bolts.
Before we get into that, Senator Castillo, would you like to testify on this, Senator?
Yes. Thank you. You're getting the explanation of how things are going to be changed in this bill, but I just wanted to explain why I am in support of this. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Susan Castillo, State Senator from District 20, Eugene. It was just brought to my attention that if we could somehow create an incentive for using recycled materials, that perhaps more of that would happen. And so that is the intent of this bill. In discussions with St. Vincent de Paul, learning about their efforts to try and get builders to look at recycled products or products from recycled materials that they were producing. And the problem was just, trying to create some markets for that so that we could develop more of that. So anyway, this is an effort to do that. And as I understand in a meeting with staff today, that is hopefully what the final version of this bill is going to look like, and that would be the intent of it. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much, Senator. Who's next here?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I am the State Purchasing Manager with DAPS, TCCS, and I'm here this afternoon to express some concerns over the bill as currently written. As I understand, the intent of the bill is to increase the amount of recycled building construction material. As the bill is currently written, it has a very broad scope. In fact, it impacts every purchase and acquisition that a public agency would make, whether it be for trade services, supplies, new equipment, or building materials, is the original intent here. Under the bill as currently written, there would be no public agency control over suitability of materials. That's something that is a problem, because we could wind up with a situation where if a bidder proposed a recycled material use, we would be obliged, as the bill is written, to apply the preference, and if that won the low bid, we'd be obliged to accept that, even if it didn't perform at the suitability standards that we would want to have and an owner would expect under a building construction scenario. The preference would apply to the entire bid price, and I don't think that was necessarily the intent here, but as written, you could potentially have $100,000 consulting contract, use $500 worth of recycled paper, and as written, that preference would apply to the total value of the contract as opposed to just the materials. So we would hope that we would get a change to just have that impact the materials. The process, as specified in the bill in front of you, is driven by the bidder. It's very difficult for a public contracting agency to be prepared to apply a preference across the board when a bidder could trigger this by simply offering in their bid to say that they're providing recycled material. So we think that there's a change needed to amend the bill to ensure that the contracting agency establishes in the bid document how the preference will be applied, and that way it will be applied evenly across the board for all bidders. And finally, the bill changes the definition of recycled material in such a way that we could have used parts proposed as a part of new equipment. There has been some discussion, particularly in the office equipment area, where people have proposed copiers, for example, that have used parts in it. And our experience has been that they simply have more downtime and more problems than equipment that has the parts going in all at the same time. Now, I don't think in talking to these gentlemen today that this was ever the intent of the bill, but those are some of the consequences that may not be intended here that would come out for public agencies. So we think that the intent could be more effectively accomplished, more efficiently accomplished with a section and statute similar to what exists in statute for recycled paper or re-refined oil. It would specifically call out the requirement to use recycled building materials for public improvement contracts involving buildings or renovations to buildings. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Mr.
Chair. Thank you for coming. questions, or go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry McDonald. I'm the director of St. Lucie Paul, Plain County. And we fully support the amendment or the comments of Mr. Petty. The intent was to try and create opportunities to increase the recycled content of material in housing construction or in commercial construction. What we have found is that there are many viable materials that can be utilized that have substantial recycled content. There are private industry, private companies that are producing those products and have a hard time getting market share or market niche open out there because the virgin manufacturers really have a very much larger base of operations. And recycled materials businesses are actually much smaller in scope and often fledgling or just getting started. And as a result of that is that they have very little market penetration, very few chances to offer to demonstrate the effectiveness of their product. They have the same underwriting criteria that everyone else does, the same quality standards, so they're a like-for-like replacement. They just have recycled content in them. One of the examples we had that was a product out of South Carolina. It was a fully recycled clothing that was shredded into a bad insulation called Insulcot from Greenland Industries. Was UL tested, approved, utilized for wall insulation as opposed to fiberglass insulation. The building trades that we dealt with indicated that they would use the product if we insisted that they use it. However, that they would charge us extra for its installation. We asked them afterwards how it was, and they said, oh, it's a lot easier to install. We never thought of using that before, and they said it was a good product. But the resistance to that type of new product or a changed product is great in the marketplace. By the state offering the opportunity to give a preference for builders that are thinking about using that product in a better way, using different products that have the same standards, the same performance, and no change in the price. So there's a hold harmless on all of this. We feel it's an opportunity for the state to increase that kind of business within the state itself. So that was the intent of this measure.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I see there has some work to be done on this, so close the public hearing. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Thank you, Senator. And then, no further business coming before the committee. Adjourned. Okay. Hey.